From Altoona to Mount Pleasant, Carlisle to Countersport, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the fight to reopen Pennsylvania in the wake of Governor Tom Wolf's draconian shutdown policies has resulted in a roller coaster ride through the court system. Attorney Mark Scaringi joins us with a status report. Pennsylvanians pay three different taxes on gasoline and diesel fuel, and due to the COVID-19 pandemic, revenue from those taxes is down. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi have an Allegheny Institute report on the impact. And the fight to confirm Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court of the United States is underway. Ashley Klingensmith of Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania is here with a Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Mark Scaringi in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. In a move that dramatically changes the landscape for both the 2022 U.S. Senate and gubernatorial races, incumbent U.S. Senator Pat Toomey announced that he will not seek re-election to the Senate when his term expires in 2 years. Toomey had been widely expected to run for governor, but said he would not seek that post either and will retire to the private sector. That leaves the Republican nominations for both statewide posts wide open, with no clear frontrunner for either. Governor Tom Wolf is term limited and cannot run for re-election, so both seats will be open in 2022. A large field of candidates is now expected to compete for both. Auditor General Eugene DePasquale has been conducting an audit of Governor Tom Wolf's catastrophic business closure orders and related waiver process. But he punted the ball last week, issuing a news release rather than an audit, delaying any firm answers on the Wolf administration's actions until after the November election. DePasquale is running in a hotly contested race for Congress in a mid-state district and has been heavily criticized for accepting campaign contributions from Wolf while simultaneously investigating his administration. David Taylor of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association pointed out, quote, "A press release is not an audit," and said the limited information released by DePasquale, quote, "does not address the relationship between businesses receiving waivers from Governor Wolf and political contributions received by Governor Tom Wolf's political campaigns from those businesses." Taylor termed the failure to release a complete audit political interference. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. The harsh shutdown policies and ongoing restrictions on businesses have resulted in mounting grassroots pushback and triggered legal action in both the state and federal court systems. Here to help us sort through all that litigation is attorney Mark Scaringi of the Scaringi & Scaringi Law Firm. Mark, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Mark, there have been a number of challenges, some of which you have been a part, to the governor's various orders in dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. There was a case involving a candidate for state representative out in Allegheny County, Danny DeVito, not he of movie fame, but his name is Danny DeVito. Tell us a little bit about that case, why it was filed, and where are we with it?
The Friends of Danny DeVito versus Governor Wolf and Secretary Levine was really one of the first cases that was filed to challenge the authority of the governor and the secretary to issue the business closure order. That was really the only order that had been issued by the governor at the time. We filed the suit very early on, very soon after March 19th, when the governor issued his business closure order. And we filed that suit in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, requesting that it take the case under its King's Bench authority. And it agreed to, and actually, in that case, the governor, who's the opposing party in the case, also agreed that the court should take jurisdiction of the matter under this extraordinary authority that it had to take matters directly to the Supreme Court, bypassing the trial courts, if you will, because it was a matter of great significance and great public importance. So it took the case. We challenged the business closure order in a couple of different ways. The first thrust of the case was to challenge the statutory authority of the governor to issue the business closure order. We focused in on the Emergency Management Services Code, which is the statute, the Pennsylvania statute, that the governor used to declare the disaster emergency. And so I said to the court, you can't allow this governor to base his authority for this closure order on the Emergency Management Services Code. This is not a natural disaster. It's a communicable disease. Make him use his power under the Disease Act, which he does have power there, but it's limited. Under the Disease Act, he can only target his quarantine order, his isolation order, his mandatory medical examination power on individuals who are infected with the communicable disease or who have likely been exposed to it, but then also that individual has due process rights. That individual has the right to notice and to challenge in court the Secretary of Health, because really the Disease Act is about the health department, the state health department and the local health departments, to challenge their action that they're taking against that individual, because the order will deprive that individual of his freedom, of his liberty, by quarantining him, by isolating him, by forcing him to receive a medical exam. You see, none of that was followed. None of the due process was followed. And of course, the governor targeted businesses, not individuals, and made no determination that our businesses were infected with COVID-19. And so that was the basis of the initial lawsuit. It was a direct challenge on the statutory authority of the governor.
What was the ultimate outcome of that suit?
Yeah, well, the ultimate outcome of the suit is the Pennsylvania Supreme Court dismissed all of the claims, including our statutory challenge and the constitutional claims that we brought. We then filed a petition for writ of certiorari in the United States Supreme Court, asking that court to take our appeal, and just the other day, the United States Supreme Court declined to do so.
So that brings to an end that line of legal challenging. However, Mark, a very important decision was issued by a federal court judge, William Stickman IV, in Allegheny County. The judge in that case, Mark, very heavily came down on the governor and said that he clearly violated constitutional rights. What did Judge Stickman rule?
Judge Stickman was a wonderful opinion. And Judge Stickman declared the congregate gathering limits, you know, the limits of no more than 25 persons indoors, no more than 250 persons outdoors, violates our First Amendment right to assembly. And thus he struck down those limits and they could not be enforced. He also declared the stay-at-home order and the business closure order violate our substantive due process rights guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. And thirdly, he declared the business closure order, remember, with its classification of all industries and life-sustaining and non-life-sustaining, violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So he struck down the business closure order, the stay-at-home order, and he also struck down the congregate gathering limits.
Which then resulted in people returning somewhat to normal activity. And the governor, of course, was not accepting of that decision and asked for a stay, which the judge denied. However, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals got involved. What happened there, Mark?
Well, regrettably, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, a panel of three judges, two appointed by former President George W. Bush, one appointed by former President Barack Obama, issued an order granting the governor's stay request, which is a request to essentially pause the effectiveness of Judge Stickman's order and opinion from earlier in the case. So now, once again, as a result of the Third Circuit, we now have the congregate gathering limits are once again imposed, and the governor, if he so chooses, can reinstitute the stay-at-home order and the business closure order.
Will that same three-judge panel ultimately be ruling on the appeal?
Yes.
What is the time frame for that happening, Mark? Because a number of us would say, hey, while this stay is in effect, we're being denied our constitutional rights. Should not a decision be forthcoming in a timely manner?
Well, it should, but it will likely take a couple of months for the court to rule on the appeal. Another disconcerting or troubling aspect of the Third Circuit's granting of the governor's stay request is that in order to do so, they have to find that the governor has a likelihood of success on the merits of his appeal. And typically, appeals in the overwhelming majority of cases are denied because typically the trial courts get it right. So the fact that the panel, the Third Circuit, found that the governor has a likelihood of success on the merits of his appeal, which it had to find in order to grant the stay, is somewhat troubling for the future prospects of the plaintiffs, the county of Butler, the individuals, the small business owners, the politicians, for ultimately having success on their appeal.
At some point, when the Third Circuit finally gets around to ruling on this, regardless of which way they rule, is this something that we might ultimately expect, Mark, to see ending up before the Supreme Court of the United States?
It's possible, Lohman. Now, the attorneys for the County of Butler, they could try what I did in the Friends of Danny DeVito case, which is apply for essentially an emergency injunction or stay. In this case, it would be a stay of the Third Circuit's order staying Judge Stickman's order. It gets a little complex. They could try that, but that's a very, very high hurdle for them to satisfy. They actually have to prove that the law is indisputably on their side. They have to prove the law is indisputably in favor of the business owners and the political candidates and opposed to the governor's position. I think they're going to have a hard time proving that, the same way I did when Justice Alito denied my emergency injunctive request. And ultimately, the Supreme Court is very, very selective in the cases that it accepts. It's another very high hurdle to get the court to hear your appeal. And they typically will only get involved when there is a conflict in circuit courts. And we don't really have that at this point. So I think it's going to be a long and difficult road to hoe, so to speak, for the plaintiffs in this case.
And likely we'll have a new governor before all of this.
That would be a great thing now, wouldn't it?
That would be a wonderful thing. We have been talking with attorney Mark Scaringe. He is the owner and firm manager of Scaringe & Scaringe. Mark, give us the website for your law firm in case folks would like to learn more about these cases, get additional information.
Sure. It's scaringilaw.com, scaringilaw.com. And we post frequently on Facebook and on Twitter about the developments in these various cases challenging this governor's executive orders.
And there's also the Mark Scaringe radio program. Folks, can they get that online as well?
They can. They can look at the podcast online, and they can tune in every Saturday on WHP 580 iHeartRadio at 1 o'clock for the Mark Scaringe Show.
We have been talking with Mark Scaringe. Mark, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you, Lohman.
Pennsylvania depends on revenue from three different gasoline taxes to help fund road and bridge repairs. But revenue is off due to a decline in consumption during the COVID-19 pandemic. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi discuss the impact on this Allegheny Institute report.
Hello, and welcome to the Allegheny Institute report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is Frank Gamrat, the executive director of the Allegheny Institute. You recently wrote a brief continuing the work that the Institute has done on the coronavirus and the various impacts on levels of government, state and local in Pennsylvania, on fuel taxes, quite an important topic. Frank, for our listeners, just to give them some background, Pennsylvania has not one, not two, but three petroleum-based taxes, which that money is essentially like a user fee. It's a tax, but it is, you know, you pay at the pump or it's bundled into the price of gasoline or petroleum somewhere that goes to fund transportation, highway and bridge improvements. Can you give our listeners an explanation of these three taxes?
Absolutely. At the start, of course, we have what's called the oil company franchise tax, and that is imposed on all oil companies doing business in Pennsylvania for the privilege of doing business in Pennsylvania. And that tax goes back to 1997. And at first, it was a millage rate imposed on a minimum price of gasoline per gallon. It was $1.25. And then in 2013, they changed it around a little bit. And by changing it around, they raised the minimum amount to $2.99 per gallon. and they added the extra millages. They rolled back the millages on the oil company franchise tax, then they added the extra millages, one on diesel, which is called fuels, and one on gasoline, which is called liquid fuels. The oil company franchise tax is 45.9 cents per gallon on gasoline and 62.4 cents per gallon on diesel, and that's known as first sale. It is done when the gasoline is first either imported into the state or refined at the state, and of course, we did have refineries in Philadelphia at one point, and I think there's still one left, but I'm not certain about that. Act 89 of 2013 added 11.7 cents per gallon to both gasoline and diesel. So there are the three taxes. The original oil company franchise tax is done on the importation or distillation, whereas the other two are done at the retail level. Now, that being said, it all gets passed to the consumer in some form or fashion. You know, it's not like the companies are doing this out of the goodness of their heart. So it all gets passed on to the consumer. It's what we see at the pump. And of course, Pennsylvania has the second highest gasoline tax in the country. As of January 20, 2020, gasoline is 57.6 cents a gallon, and diesel is 74.1 cents per gallon. So we have the two highest in the nation. Now, of course, he said those are the three that Pennsylvania levies, collected at the pump and paid monthly. And so that goes into highway and bridge maintenance and repair, and only for highway and bridge maintenance and repair. And one of the things that we looked at, of course, is that how did those collections work over the last fiscal year, 2019-2020, compared to A, their estimated, or B, their what was done the previous fiscal year.
Keep going with that thought, because obviously we had a shutdown. We had people working from home, people furloughed, people laid off, people not traveling to go anywhere for months during this fiscal year. So can you give our listeners, now that there's been some more recent data that's been released, what you found, what happened with the revenues on those taxes?
Absolutely. Of course, the fiscal year ended June 30th, 2020, and so we were able to get that data and compare it. Now, let's take the first one, the oil company franchise tax. The state revenue department estimated that they get about $1 billion from that tax when they first were doing their estimates for the fiscal year 2020. And of course, no one saw the COVID monster hiding in the closet and coming out and getting anyone. That sort of caused some issues. And we ended up at $931 million, about 7.4% less than the estimates. The economy was doing well. The collections were doing well for the first 9 months plus. You know, get into mid-March, things were doing well. March fell a little bit from February, but through February, it was running 1.7% ahead of projection. So like I said, things were doing well till COVID struck. And then, of course, the wheels fell off the bus, as they say. The collections in April, not so bad, but May was really bad. May was down 66% from April. You know, May they collected 26.5 million. May was 26.5 and April was 77 million. And then the previous May was 81.9 million. So you were 68% lower there. And even June was down. So those last 3 months of April, May, and June, specifically May and June, the oil company franchise tax really fell hard, understanding that the importation and the distillation was not setting up for a good summer. The diesel fuel tax, that one actually ran okay. And the reason we say that it ran okay is because even during the lockdown, delivery trucks were still running. For the most part, delivery trucks were still running. The estimated 1.42 million in diesel tax collections came in at 142.1. So they were only $800,000 off what they thought they would get. So that remained pretty decently. Again, it was doing fairly consistent throughout the fiscal year, so it really wasn't much of a problem. April, May, June were down a little bit, maybe 1-2% depending on the month, but for overall, because the deliveries kept on rolling and humming, that wasn't too bad. The problem child in all this is the gasoline tax. And of course, the gasoline tax came in about $30 million short. They were expecting $522 million. They got about $493 million. And this one's interesting because through the first 9 months through February, it was actually running a little bit ahead. There was a little glitch with some collections in August, and we do address that. But after talking with the Department of Revenue, it was just a matter of getting it. There was collection errors in the beginning, end of the fiscal 19 year, beginning 2020 year, but it had been running a little bit ahead through February. And then, of course, with the lockdown, people were not allowed to go out and do much of anything. The commuters were down. Vacation travel, certainly May was down. And so that's really where a lot of that happened to be, was in those final 2 months, really of May and June. Quite frankly, we think that may be continued in through the summer season. Now, we don't have July and August numbers yet, but not really sure what the summer held. We know a lot of people were not going anywhere, certainly weren't flying, so maybe it bounced back a little bit. But the big picture is you're down about $100 million, $70 million from the oil company franchise tax, and $30 million from the gasoline tax, and $800,000 from the diesel tax. So this goes into highway and bridge maintenance. And so now that you're short, what can the state do? And of course, from our end, we say, look, you know, let's take a look at this prevailing wage law. This COVID-19 has caused everyone, private sector, public sector, a chance to think and rethink how business is done. Prevailing wage is an old concept from the 1920s, the old Davis-Bacon laws, that was designed to protect, you know, union workers. And so what it does is the Department of Labor and Industry sets a wage rate for every occupation. And that wage rate has to be met by all contractors if a project has public money. Now, most non-union contractors have no trouble meeting that wage rate, but where they struggle is this notion of benefits. Prevailing wage law also specifies that a level of benefits must be paid. Now, if you're a union shop, you're working with a co-op of benefits, and you can just kind of purchase in and offer your workers health care, whatever those other benefits may be, off of the payroll. For a non-union shop, where they don't have such a co-op, if they can't offer medical insurance or any of those other benefits, they have to pay a dollar equivalent into the employee's payroll. What happens there is that dollar equivalent then becomes subject to the payroll tax, Social Security tax, income tax, all that kind of stuff. So it actually becomes more expensive than just, hey, you need to offer benefits, because now you have to pay the taxes on top of that. And as a result, a lot of union workers, a lot of union firms just don't bid on these things. We owe it to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to do this stuff as efficiently as we can. And if that means bringing in non-union workers and non-union firms to bid on projects, if they can do it well and for a cheaper price, I think we need to think about that.
Frank, great stuff as always, and our listeners can visit our website, which is www.alleghenyinstitute.org, to see this brief. You can follow us on Twitter. For Frank Gamrat, this is Eric Montardi, and this has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
President Trump has nominated Judge Amy Coney Barrett to an open seat on the Supreme Court, and the confirmation process is about to get underway. Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity talks about it on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
With the passing of the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a third Supreme Court vacancy arose for President Trump and the United States Senate to fill. There's been a seemingly endless stream of commentary about the process and about Amy Coney Barrett's qualifications. It is important to understand the constitutional duties of the President and Senate, as that can answer any and all procedural objections that have been raised since the discussion around filling this vacancy began. Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2 is known as the Appointments Clause. It empowers the President to nominate, and with the confirmation, advice and consent of the United States Senate, to appoint public officials, including justices of the Supreme Court. The President has the power to nominate, and the Senate possesses the power to reject or confirm his or her nominee, serving as a check on the executive's power. It's critical to understand that this is the lone constitutional language that directs this process. So, as you hear analysis about the process considerations, all one needs to cite is Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2, as the sole authority directing the process. When it comes to Americans for Prosperity's engagement in the confirmation process, we enumerated principles that would guide our decision on whether or not we would support a nominee. They are the following: that the judge be fair, independent-minded, understand the proper role of a judge, and decides cases based on the law rather than any personal agenda. Upon President Trump's announcement last month that his nominee would be Amy Coney Barrett, Americans for Prosperity acted immediately to endorse and engage in the process because, first and foremost, Judge Barrett will put the Constitution first, defend our freedoms, and not legislate from the bench. Her opinions and writings reveal a judicial philosophy that is rooted in the Constitution and understanding of the role of a judge. When interpreting the Constitution or statutes, Judge Barrett looks to the plain text, focusing on the ordinary public meaning when it was written, rather than legislating from the bench or injecting her own views. In Judge Barrett's own words, "The basic insight of originalism is that the Constitution is a law and should be interpreted like one. Thus, where the meaning of text is ascertainable, the judge must apply it." Judge Barrett's education, high-profile clerkships, work as a professor, and recent confirmation to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit is a deep bench of accomplishments. Indeed, during her nomination to the Seventh Circuit, Judge Barrett received endorsements from all 49 full-time Notre Dame Law School faculty, 500 Notre Dame Law School alumni, every Supreme Court law clerk in the October term 1998, and an ideologically diverse group of legal scholars. The Senate hearings begin October 12th. Senators, regardless of party, who desire to fill the current vacancy with a jurist who respects the Constitution and respects their distinct role as lawmakers, should support Judge Barrett. To date, Americans for Prosperity activists across all 50 states have sent over 200,000 letters to their United States senators. The action each of you listening can take now is to visit uniteforbarrett.com and sign the letter. From there, you can also share this action to your Facebook and Twitter pages. Additionally, we'd ask that you join our Facebook group, Confirm Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. I'm Ashley Klingensmith, State Director with Americans for Prosperity. You can find us on Facebook by searching at PAAFP and on Twitter by searching at AFP Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 25 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WEXC-FM and WGRP-AM in Greenville, along with WTKT-AM in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.